So I wanted to talk a little bit about finish a strand that we started last week and just finish up with that. And the strand we started talking about faith, and I found this quote that I really liked from Father Thomas Keating, and it's a slightly difficult quote, but he says faith precedes belief systems. Okay, faith comes before a belief system. So first faith is born in the heart, and then a belief system is formed around that. Interesting idea. Because what are we talking about with faith? Faith in what? Right? So faith precedes belief systems. And then he says this, there is a consent or a surrender to divine reality before it's broken down into different belief systems, which are bound to be influenced by cultural conditions. I want to break that apart for a moment. There's two main things I want to look at here. One, he says there's some essence, right? Some kind of quality, which he says is consent or surrender to divine reality. What does he mean here? Anybody have another way of saying that? He says, faith precedes belief systems. There is a consent or a surrender to divine reality before it's then broken down into different belief systems. So there's some kind of initial spark. What's another way of saying that? Any other ideas?
Inspiration and happiness.
Okay, there's some kind of inspiration, some kind of deep joy that might be born in the heart. What else?
Simply a strong feeling.
Yeah, right? There's just some kind of strong feeling. Unarticulated, right? Mm-hmm. Some kind, what else? How about it from anybody's life? Something, you're all here for some reason, right? Because something has happened in your heart. What's another way of describing what happened in your heart?
Motivated desire.
Motivated desire. Yeah, desire is a good one. There's some kind of deep desire. Rumi talks about it as a longing. Has anybody ever felt a longing? A deep, unarticulable longing, right? So in a sense, we could say that we could rephrase it as that. There is some deep, unarticulable longing before it's broken down into a belief system.
It's a peace.
Yeah. A peace? Yeah.
I was just thinking back when I was, half size and everything, and the reason why I continued to do it was because you felt that peace, and another reason why I come here is because you feel that peace.
Yeah, there's some connection. Connectivity to a whole. There is a fitting in with a larger whole. So, and then he says, right, this wholeness, this beauty that is sparked in our hearts then gets bound in cultural conditions. And then it gets labeled. And my friend says, when you label me, you limit me. but it's this idea that when you're labeled, right, it's limited. So the minute you label it, it limits it. And you start to see a very interesting pattern that happens, right? There's some small awakening, some small voice, right? In the Christian tradition of Bede Griffiths and Swami Abhisiktananda, they call it the still voice within, the small still voice within, right? There's some small still, meaning non-wavering, like a candle that's just totally non-flickering, totally still voice deep within us. That's calling us to awaken. And then we create a belief system around that. And then we begin to almost stagnate in that belief system. I mean, we can see that in many different religious circumstances. It's almost like a three-part system I was thinking about. So it's first to awaken to, right? And then to move towards. And then to almost lock down on it. Anybody have an example of how this might happen?
Learning a language.
How so?
Like if you
go into an immersive environment, say whatever, say you go to Mexico and you spend time there and you go from knowing nothing to knowing some, and you are kind of creating this combo language where you mix what you know from your previous life with what you're learning every day, and then you get a handle on the basics, and then you get, eventually you're there long enough to know and be able to think in that language.
Yeah.
And then the creativity that you might have had that first, when you first had a handle on it, where you were kind of putting all of those pieces together, it goes away because you learned.
So you've almost habituated it. Yeah, that could be one way of, anybody else have a different way of about it? Thinking about it?
Understanding.
Yeah, like what is it? There's an initial spark, and then there's a moving towards, and then there's a kind of stagnation that can happen.
Education.
How so?
Can you look at a child who's in like, what's that, the one before the grades? Thank you. Kindergarten, and they're alive and electric and curious. Then you look at them in high school and they're dead.
Yeah. you certainly see that in the education system. Obviously it happens in our spiritual life too, right? There's a stagnation that can happen. We want to be comfortable. Matt, were you able to turn that air on?
I don't know how to turn it on.
crank it up, Lauren.
I don't think you can.
Yeah, you can.
Not cold.
There we go.
Suppose diet is a good example.
Yeah.
Anything where you set a goal that you're inspired by initially that drives you from within, and then you get into the thing where it becomes an I have to, and then it loses its interesting, motivating factor, and then you end up just doing it because you're supposed to and not because you're motivated from inside.
Yeah. And, the issue is how to not stagnate, or how to stagnate and then break through to a different level, right? If there is this cycle of an initial awakening and then a movement towards and then a stagnation, how to keep that cycle moving, How to keep the awareness open enough to move through that cycle. And it seems like to successfully navigate a cycle like that is to learn to be able to endure anxiety. Okay, to learn to be able to endure anxiety, or to learn, as we said last week, to learn to wait without hope. Right? You guys know the T.S. Eliot quote? I said to my soul, be still and wait without hope, for hope would be hope in the wrong thing. Okay? What does he mean there? Wait without hope, for hope would be hope in the wrong thing. The minute I label what I'm hoping for, dear Santa, dear Jesus, please bring me a new bicycle. Right? Like there is a label onto what I want. There's a label. And then, I'm hoping for a specific thing. But what is it to hope without hope? What is it to wait without hope?
To be open in that way?
Yeah, to be open. Which means to be able to endure anxiety, to be able to endure the unknown. I want to pause here for a moment and come back to something we talked about last week, real briefly. There was a TV show, a 10-part series called 500 Nations, and we talked about this a little bit last week. And in it, they described the destruction of all 500 native nations in North America when the Europeans came over. And as I was watching this, this question came up for me. If I were the chief of one of these nations, how would I have led my people? Okay? So everybody, for a moment, stay with me. What was happening was each chief was dealing with the onslaught of the European... invasion in a different way. Some people were trying to negotiate with us, Some chiefs were trying to fight us. Some chiefs were trying to integrate with us. Well, let's adopt some of the ways of the white men, and then we can keep some of our ways. In the end, after I watched this 30-hour series, I realized that all methods failed. Okay? All methods failed because all nations were annihilated. more or less. So the question that came to me was, how would I act differently if I had known that? And I was the chief. Is everybody clear on the question? How would you then act if you knew that, in a sense, that annihilation was inevitable? In a sense, what is the essence? And there's there's two spheres of which we can act from in our day-to-day lives. There's two spheres of which we can act from. I think of them as like an inner and an outer sphere. And the outer sphere we can think of as apparent reality. And the inner sphere I'm just going to call ultimate reality. Now, the outer sphere is where I act most of my time. And this is trying to figure out each situation how to act appropriately, right? So, like, okay, should I fight against the invasion or should I try to not fight against the invasion? How can I work with the apparent reality to get in my way, basically? How can I form things to make it work out for me? And in a sense, this is what we do all day long, right? With work, with relationships. And what I want to suggest is that there's a whole other sphere that's going on, which the spiritual traditions talk about. And if we were to talk about this in terms of Native Americans, right? How they were dealing with this oppression, we could say that, in a sense, one way you can act in that situation is to act, how to put this? Well, let me put it to you for a second. How would you act if it didn't matter, right, that it was going to be annihilation either way? How would you lead your people if you were a chief?
In peace and nonviolence.
In peace and nonviolence, Barbie says. What else?
Fight to the death.
Doug says fight to the death. Okay.
I think you gave the example of the lion.
Yeah. What lion?
Some tribe, and this member of the tribe was being eaten by a lion. And so I guess the tribe was encouraging him to just stay inside because he was going to get eaten anyway, but to just practice.
I don't remember this.
No?
No.
Oh, my God. But just, you know, encouraged to practice staying within.
To keep practicing.
Yeah, no matter the pain.
All right. What else? What are some other ways?
Some kind of contentment.
Some kind of contentment.
Whether it's, you know, almost maybe giving people an option. But just trying to find some way for everyone to arrive in a place within themselves where they aren't unhappy necessarily.
Yeah. I mean, what are we talking about, right? What are we talking about? In a sense, it's the question is the same that we're dealing with. What are we trying to do with our minds and our lives? What are we hoping for in this life? Throw out one word answers. What are we hoping for in this life?
Big reward.
Big reward. What else?
Happiness.
Happiness. I mean, is there anything more essential than happiness that we're hoping for?
Yummy happiness.
Okay, we could say yummy happiness.
Love.
Yeah, I mean, I think, really, that, like, the key to happiness is some kind of deep love. Again, this is this faith before belief system. We have some deep faith in the quality of love. You see what I mean? That's what we as a species have some deep faith in. Before it's labeled in its different cultural conditions. It's some deep faith in the power of love. So in this other sphere, right, the actions are only based on love. You see, in the deeper sphere, how you act is only based on love, not based on what's happening in an apparent reality. So in that way, you're in a sense, you're not using all of your energy to negotiate with the oppressor. Now think about that for a minute. You're not using your energy to negotiate with the oppressor. Rather, you're using your energy to serve the power of love and humanity. Now, what do you do most of the day? Are you using your energy to negotiate with the oppressor? Or are you using your energy to serve the power of love and humanity? I guarantee 99% of my day I am fighting the oppressor. And it comes in all of the little ways I blame everybody and everything for everything that's going wrong for me. The smallest things. Again, and this comes with watching the mind, keeping some kind of book or keeping some kind of morality thing, right? Is that every time you blame your partner for something, you're using your energy to fight the oppressor, as opposed to using your limited energy to expound upon the powers of love and humanity. And you are, right, the chief of a nation. And how are you going to use that energy? I came upon this quote from an old meditation master. He actually wrote a manual on how to do a 3-year retreat. But he says, whether you are physically ill, troubled in your mind, insulted by others or bothered by enemies and disputes, in short, whatever annoyance, major or minor, comes up in your life or affairs, do not lay the blame on anything else, thinking that such and such caused this or that problem. Rather, you should consider, this mind grasps at a self where there is no self. From time without beginning until now, it has, in following its own whims in samsara, perpetrated various non-virtuous actions. Okay? And I realize, I've told you this story before. I was at the airport and there's a couple fighting, right? And she turned to her husband and she said, you know, honey, you can be right or you can be happy, and that's your choice. And I was thinking about this again tonight, and I realized that that is the same battle I'm fighting all the time. Because every time I'm right, I'm talking about a belief system. You see? And every time I'm you can feel that come up, right? I want to be right. I want to support some kind of belief. I want to support some kind of belief that I'm right. And the only thing I think we can know for certain is that we're wrong. And you know when you're 16 and you're so certain you know everything? Right? And you really do. We've talked about this, there is a wisdom to being 16, right? But then when you get older, you're like, holy shit, there were actually things that I didn't know. Like now I look at 16-year-olds and I'm like, you actually don't know everything. And I know you don't, because I remember thinking that I did know everything when I was 16. And we're in that same boat now. I mentioned once before that I was doing a debrief with some people I was teaching a class with, and there were two women in their 60s. And one woman said, I enjoyed teaching with you, Will, because, you know, your youthfulness, and this was a couple years ago before I lost my youthfulness. And then she turned to this other woman and she said, I enjoyed teaching with you because you have life experience. And immediately in my mind I thought, wait a second, I have as much life experience as you guys have, you know? And there was this authentic feeling of that, of like, yeah, I have as much. Now, these are two women that have gone through childbirth, that have had careers, raised family, you know. I simply, in fact, don't have the life experience they have. But there's something in my mind, even right now as I'm telling this story, that feels like I actually do have that same life experience. So even though I don't believe it, there's a part of me that knows that I don't know. You see what I mean? But I don't know what it is I don't know. I have to not know, because I can look in the past and say that certainly in the past I was ignorant. We are all in that same boat. On little levels, we're so certain that we have life pretty much figured out. Whatever our belief system has come to be. You know, my grandfather believed that we came from alien garbage. That this was an alien garbage dump. You know, that's a belief system. And then everything starts to form around that and you figure it out from there, right? So we all have some kind of belief system. That is holding us stagnant in some kind of way. that's holding us stagnant in some kind of way. So to be able to transgress that, to be able to move through the spiritual life, is to be able to endure the anxiety of not knowing. Okay? And to be able to endure the anxiety of not knowing is to be able to rest in the center sphere, right? Which is that the unarticulable sense of love and humanity is the guiding principle. The Buddha said, you know, at one point he said, if I had to succinct all my, I don't know if that's a word or properly used, but if I had to condense all of my teachings into one simple teaching, he said it'd be attribute all blames to a single source. What do you think that source is?
Yeah,
your mother and your father. No, it's what? It's
ourselves.
Yeah, it's ourselves. Now, here's the thing. This is my last time with you, and I'm already running late. It's so hard to convince somebody of the laws of karma, for example, of cause and effect. Of the seeds you plant are going to be what you reap, right? What you sow, so shall you reap. But ask yourself, what would it look like in terms of happiness if you lived a life based on that? What would it look like in terms of happiness if you were to live a life based on those principles? And I think of... Martin Luther King, right? And he says, this power of love. And I remember one day I did this experiment. I watched like maybe 20 YouTube videos of Martin Luther King Jr. And then I watched about 20 YouTube videos of Malcolm X. Two people in the same movement coming about it with different qualities, right? Malcolm X was about blame, and Martin Luther King Jr. was about the quality of love, right? And it was just fascinating to watch them side by side. And to realize this kind of, I don't know how to say it, this kind of beauty that I could see in Martin Luther King Jr.'s teachings. But this, he says, this is a quote of one of his speeches. He says, "This is what Jesus meant when he said, love your enemies. And I'm happy that he didn't say, like your enemies. Because there are some people that I find it pretty difficult to like. Liking is an affectionate emotion, and I can't like anybody who would bomb my home. But Jesus reminds us that love is greater than liking. Love is understanding, creative, redemptive goodwill towards all men." You see? So this is a power. Again, I'm always coming back to this idea of, is a chief, right, of a nation that's about to be annihilated brutally. What's some quality that I could serve? What can I serve in that moment? And we see with Martin Luther King Jr., it's this quality of love, an understanding, creative, redemptive goodwill towards all men, even as they're bombing your home. And he says this, "Bomb our homes and threaten our children, and as difficult as it is, we will still love you. Send your hooded perpetrators of violence into our communities at the midnight hour and drag us out onto some wayside road and leave us half dead as you beat us, and we will still love you. But be assured that we'll wear you down by our capacity to suffer, and one day we will win our freedom. But we will not only win freedom for ourselves, we will so appeal to your heart and conscience that we will win you in the process. And our victory will be a double victory." Right, we will so appeal to your heart, right? We will so appeal to that deep essence in you that you are also longing for, right? Because you see, we talked about demons last weekend, right? And a demon is somebody who's suffering and wants to bring you down too. They don't want to suffer alone, right? But what they really want more than anything is love. I didn't believe in demons, just to get personal for a moment. I didn't believe in demons, and then I met one, and I suddenly believed in demons, right? And I was talking to one of my teachers about it. I said, "How do you deal with demons?" And he said, "The only way you can really deal with a demon is to love them and keep them close to you." And you see, what I was doing was trying to get them away from me, right? But it's a different thing. It's try to keep them close to you. and love them. And you can see that's what Martin Luther King Jr. was doing in the South in the 60s, right? But be assured that we'll wear you down by our capacity to suffer, and one day we will win our freedom. We will not only win freedom for ourselves, we will so appeal to your heart and conscience that we will win your freedom in the process. It's a totally radical different way of approaching life, right? And then our victory will be a double victory. And then he says, if there is to be peace on earth and goodwill toward men, we must finally believe in the ultimate morality of the universe and believe that all reality hinges on moral foundations. All reality hinges on moral foundations. And one last thing, when I read that, it reminded me of... maybe I don't have it. But it was Mahatma Gandhi talking... Talking about how he learned nonviolence. Who was his main teacher in nonviolence? He said, I learned the lesson of nonviolence from my wife. When I tried her to bend her to my will... when I tried to bend her to my will, her determined resistance to my will on the one hand and her quiet submission to the suffering my stupidity brought about on the other ultimately made me ashamed of myself and cured me of my stupidity in thinking that I was born to rule over her. And in the end, she became my teacher in nonviolence. Interesting, right? Because that's the same way he dealt with the British. In a sense, he just became a mirror of their own stupidity. And that's the same thing Martin Luther King Jr. did with the white supremacists, right? He just became a mirror of their own stupidity. And there's something in that that essence of love and humanity, right? When we just simply reflect that, when we just simply shine that's the only thing we have to attend to. You see? And then what happens on the external reality... What's happening in the apparent sphere doesn't matter, you see? Because in a sense, Martin Luther King Jr., as he was serving love and as he was serving the power of love, it appeared that he was causing more problems, right? It appeared that more people were getting killed because of it, more disruption was erupting because of it, and many of the black ministers of that time were telling him not to stop doing what he was doing and stop disrupting things. So, right? So that there's an apparent realm, there's no causal relationship there, right? That is coming from something else. But on an ultimate reality realm and an ultimate sphere, it's just to serve that power of love, right? Is the only thing we have to attend to, and then everything else will fall in its place. So I was thinking about that in terms of the native cultures, right? And if I were some kind of chief, whatever it looked like in each situation, if I could have the courage to serve love, right? That would be really, it seemed to be the only answer. and I think we'll end there.